वासुदेवाय
नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय
ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय
नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय
ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय
हरे
कृष्ण 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 हरे 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 राम 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 हरे हरे
श्री प्रभुपाद की जय. So the chapter 2 is entitled The Contents of the Gita Summarized. In other words, it is a summary of the entire Bhagavad Gita. And all the major themes in Bhagavad Gita will be mentioned in the second chapter and then developed much more thoroughly throughout the rest of the remaining 16 chapters. And the second chapter picks up on some major themes already mentioned in the first chapter. The major theme is, why is Arjuna paralyzed in accomplishing or executing his duty? And if we understand that, then we'll understand why we ourselves might not be so enthusiastic about being involved in spiritual life. And also, another thing that's pertinent to life today is a false sense or a false object of compassion. And we're going to discuss those two things first. First of all, Arjuna's dilemma, the reason why he is full of dualities and somewhat fearful, and he's emotionally distraught, is because of something mentioned in the first chapter, text 36. Arjuna says, Papam evashayed asman hatvaitan atatayinaha tasman narha vayam hantum dhratarashtran chabandavan swajanam hi katam hatva sukina shama madhava. So the key word here is swajanam. Swajanam means my people, my kinsmen, my family members, my kind. And he says, swajanam hi hatam hatva. How could I ever be happy? Swajanam hi katam hatva sukina. How could I ever be happy? By killing my own kinsmen. So, this is the dilemma Arjuna is in. He has a bodily attachment to members of his extended family, and therefore it's holding him back from doing his duty. And to such a point that he's willing to say no to God. That's how serious this kind of attachment can be. And then the second theme is mentioned in the first chapter, 28th verse. Of course, let's read the first chapter, 36th verse. He says, sin will overcome us if we slay such aggressors. Therefore, it is not proper for us to kill the sons of Dhritarashtra and our friends. What should we gain, O Krishna, husband and goddess of fortune? And how could we be happy by killing our own kinsmen? So, this is on one level, true. On another level, misconception. On the mundane level, if you take Krishna out of the equation, what he's saying is true. But on a higher level, you bring Krishna back into the equation, what he's saying is misconception. So now if we go to first chapter 28th verse, Arjuna says, "My dear Krishna, seeing my friends and relatives present before me in such a fighting spirit, I feel the limbs of my body quivering and my mouth drying up." So, now this is a very interesting point, that the way Prabhupada makes this, makes this purport. He says that any man who has genuine devotion to the Lord has all the good qualities which are found in godly persons or in the demigods. Whereas the non-devotee, however advanced he may be in material qualifications by education and culture, lacks in godly qualities. As such, Arjuna, just after seeing his kinsmen, friends, and relatives on the battlefield, was at once overwhelmed by compassion for them, who had so decided to fight amongst themselves. As far as his soldiers were concerned, he was sympathetic from the beginning, but he felt compassion even for the soldiers of the opposite party, foreseeing their imminent death. And while he was so thinking, the limbs of his body began to quiver and his mouth became dry. He was more or less astonished to see their fighting spirit. Practically the whole community, all blood relatives of Arjuna, had come to fight with him. This overwhelmed a kind devotee like Arjuna. Although it is not mentioned here, still one can easily imagine that not only were Arjuna's bodily limbs quivering and his mouth drying up, but he was also crying out of compassion. Such symptoms in Arjuna were not due to weakness, but to his soft-heartedness, a characteristic of a pure devotee of the Lord. It is said, therefore, yasyasti bhakti bhagavat yakinchana, one who has unflinching devotion for the personality of Godhead has all the good qualities of demigods, but one who is not a devotee of the Lord has only material qualifications that are of little value. This is because he is hovering on the mental plane and is certain to be attracted by the glaring material energy. So, there's a difference between weakness and softness of the heart. But this theme of compassion is picked up in the first verse of the second chapter, where it says, Sanjaya said, "Seeing Arjuna full of compassion, his mind depressed, his eyes full of tears, Madhusudana, Krishna spoke the following words." And in the purport, Prabhupada says, "Material compassion, lamentation, and tears are all signs of ignorance of the real self. Compassion for this eternal soul is self-realization." The word Madhusudana is significant in this verse. Lord Krishna killed the demon Madhu, and now Arjuna wanted Krishna to kill the demons of misunderstanding that had overtaken him in the discharge of his duty. No one knows where compassion should be applied. Compassion for the dress of a drowning man is senseless. A man fallen in the ocean of ignorance cannot be saved simply by rescuing his outer dress, the gross material body. One who does not know this and laments for the outward dress is called a sudra, or one who laments unnecessarily. Arjuna was a kshatriya, and this conduct was not expected from him. Lord Krishna, however, can dissipate the lamentation of the ignorant man, and for this purpose, the Bhagavad Gita was sung by him. This chapter instructs us in self-realization by an analytical study of the material body and the spirit soul, as explained by the Supreme Authority, Lord Sri Krishna. This realization is possible when one works without attachment to fruitive results and is situated in the fixed conception of the real self. So that's the key. The last line is the key. Arjuna, obviously, is a devotee. His qualities are genuinely good. But he's making the same mistake that ordinary people make. That is, he's giving more importance to his bodily relationship to family members. And he's showing compassion not to the soul of these people, but rather to the bodies of these people. It's just like once a man was drowning and a lifeguard went out to save him, and sometimes when people are drowning they're panicked. So when he tried to save the man was fighting with him out of panic state of mind. And he grabbed hold of the shirt of the man and dragged it back to shore. And when he got there, he showed everyone he saved the man. But actually, it was only his shirt. The man was still out there. So, saving the shirt but losing the person is not real compassion. And in this way, Arjuna, as ordinary people do, they're very compassionate for the body of a person. Like, let's say someone is very sick. So, you know, people do everything, their family members do everything to save them. You know. And their hope is, you know, that the person can live a little bit longer. Well, that's normal. Anyone would do that. But sometimes they will undergo, they'll submit their loved one to all kinds of treatments that are actually detrimental for them. Now, most people don't know whether something is good or bad. You know, whether chemotherapy is good or bad, or radiation therapy is good or bad, or certain drugs are good or bad. They just hope that the doctor knows what he's talking about. But usually, not usually, but often, people are devastated by those procedures or those drugs. So much so that they're sedated most of the time. And in that sedated state, sometimes they come out, sometimes they don't. And they can die completely not conscious of what's happening to them. So people get so scared, and they're willing to do anything to save a loved one. When everything is almost over and a person is actually dying, then they say, let's go to the temple and pray. Let's try that also. So the trouble is, sometimes it's too late. And the person's already devastated by all the treatments. So it's a very tricky thing in life to make the right decision. And sometimes we get blinded by our attachment, our physical or family attachment, and we get panicked. We don't make the right decisions. Well, this is the condition of Arjuna. He is panicked. And he knows that he's confused. He knows that he's not in the right state of mind. How does he know? Well, he's arguing with Krishna. He's trying to not do his duty, the thing that he's been trained to do. And the reason for that is his panic state of mind due to his attachment to his kinsmen, his swajanam, his people. Right? And also, you see, he has good qualities. But sometimes, even though one has good qualities, their priorities may be wrong. Like, for example, if you're a manager of a temple, what should be the priorities of a manager? Let's say of an ISKCON temple. There's different things to consider. Like, first of all, should be Krishna and Prabhupada. And then devotees. But sometimes people say, no, it should be devotees, then Prabhupada, then Krishna. Well, if you take that priority, you will make major mistakes. And that's exactly what Arjuna is doing. He's putting his family members first, then Krishna, and then maybe his gurus or advisors. And because of that, he's coming up panicked, confused, and misplacing his compassion. So in any endeavor, there are five factors. One is the place, meaning the body. And then two is the senses. Three is the person. Four is the endeavor. And five is Krishna. Now, most people only take the first four into consideration and ignore number five. That's what Arjuna is doing here. Now, why does it say body and senses? You would think the senses are part of the body. Why would it say body? Because it's like this. Let's say you buy a car, and it's a brand new car, but it doesn't have a steering wheel, doesn't have a horn, doesn't have lights, doesn't have tires. It's got everything else, but it doesn't have the tires, right? And it doesn't have a battery. You bought a car, it's a car, right? Everything is new, but it doesn't have those things. So can you drive it? No. It's the same with the body. You have a body, it has a heart, has intestines, has esophagus, has lungs, but it doesn't have eyes, doesn't have ears, doesn't have nose, doesn't have a tongue, and doesn't have a skin. Would you be able to do anything? Mm-hmm. No. The difference in body and the senses are instruments for satisfying desires. And the body is the substratum of that. It's the support of that. But if you don't have the senses, you won't be able to effectively use the body. You have a body. You will be alive, but you won't be able to satisfy your senses. You won't be able to satisfy your desires. It'll be very, very difficult. And same with the car. It's a brand new car, but it's lacking what you need to satisfy your desire of driving it around. So you have the satisfaction of having a new car, but you won't be able to use it to please yourself. Right? So therefore, there's a difference between the body and the senses. So you have body, the senses, the person, meaning person who has desires, how to use the body and the senses, right? And you have the endeavor, and then you have Krishna. Now, what should be the priority? Priority should be number one, Krishna. And number two, we have to pay attention to our desires. If we desire to please Krishna, then not only Krishna helps us. Krishna helps us both ways. He helps us to please him. He helps us to displease him. If we want to use the body not to please Krishna, we can't do it without his help. Nothing would work in the body. The finger wouldn't be able to bend. You wouldn't be able to breathe. You wouldn't be able to speak. You know, he gives us the ability to be able to use the senses, just like Toyota or General Motors gives you the ability to navigate your car. They give you a navigation system. They give you a good steering wheel. They give you good tires. They give you a good engine, energy efficient engine, right? They give you a good starter. Every time you start it, goes and starts right away. You don't have to crank it to get the car to start. So they give you all these things that facilitate you driving the car. The same way, Krishna has given us all these things to facilitate us. Either we want to please him, or we want to go against his desire. Both ways he has to help us. Both ways, Toyota is going to help you, or GM is going to help you, by making the car respond in such a way that you can actually use it to satisfy your desire to go here or there. So in the same way, Krishna has to help us both ways. But if we decide to use the body and the senses and the mind and intelligence to please Krishna, and that depends on our desire, then not only helps us to achieve that desire, but he makes it easy and to sustain that continued desire. If we desire not to please Krishna, then to help us understand that we made a mistake, he mercifully makes us subject to the laws of karma. He mercifully makes us subject to the laws of God. Why? Just like you mercifully give some punishment to your child if the child misbehaves. Hare Krishna. Nice to meet you. Everything went all right?
Yeah.
Good.
He just wanted to meet you.
Yes. Okay. Hare Krishna. You see, you mercifully will give some remedial punishment to your child to teach them they made a mistake. They did the wrong thing. Now, if you don't do that, and your child grows up to be a monster, whose fault is it? Is it your fault or the child's fault? It's your fault. You didn't do anything to correct the child. The child never learned the difference between right and wrong. You said, oh, he's burning down the house. Oh, how wonderful. Well, that's good intelligence. You know. But that's foolish. You know, you never taught the child not to play with matches. You never taught the child he shouldn't smoke. You let the child just run around wild all the time, do whatever they want. See? So, therefore, it's your fault, not the child's fault. So, therefore, the laws of karma are to help us learn that we're making bad choices. So, but there's confusion there also, because sometimes there's good karma, sometimes there's bad karma. We think the good karma is good, we think the bad karma is bad. But actually, they're both bad. There's another confusion. Both of them are bad, because the good karma convinces us to continue in material life. And the bad karma makes us think twice about what we're doing. But even if you think twice about what you're doing, it doesn't mean that you'll come to the right conclusion. Just like you see Kamsa, he kept Vasudeva and Devaki in prison. He killed their first six children. The seventh one appeared to be a miscarriage. And the eighth one, he tried to kill, but they had already changed the children. Krishna went to Vrindavan to Nanda Maharaj and Yasoda. And Nanda Maharaj and Yasoda's child, Yogamaya, came back to the prison. Kamsa tried to kill Yogamaya, and she flew up in the air, manifested her form. Actually, Yogamaya is different than Durga, but when Kamsa saw Yogamaya, he didn't see Yogamaya, he saw Durga. Because materialists see Durga, the devotees see Yogamaya. So he saw Durga, and he was extremely afraid, and she chastised him, "You nonsense, you think you can kill Krishna? But he's already far away, and he's going to kill you as prophesied." Then he became very contrite, and he apologized to Vasudeva and Devaki for killing six of their kids. And then let them out of jail and apologized. And then he went back and sat down on his throne, and all his friends came. But all his friends were demons. Putana, Denuka Sura, Arista Sura, and Aga Sura, all asuras. And they said, "Oh, wait a minute. Why did you let them out of prison? I mean, Krishna got away. We'll kill him. Don't worry. We're going to kill every child." And they build up his false ego again. He put Rasadeva and Devaki in prison again. You see, that's the effect of bad association. Now, tell me who your friends are, I will tell you who you are. You're associating with meat eaters, woman hunters, drunkards, and for sure you're going to end up like them, right? Birds of a feather flock together. Right? So we have desires. The quality of those desires determine who we are. Everybody has desires. And you can never stop desiring. The Mayavadis say you have to stop all desires. That's nonsense. You can't stop. You can artificially stop for a little while, but they'll always come back. Excuse me. Ultimately, you desire liberation. That's also a material desire. Liberation is also a material desire. So the Mayavadis and personalists, they don't want to please Krishna. They don't desire to please Krishna. They desire to attain liberation or attain mystical powers or attain knowledge or attain heavenly planets. Those are all desires, and all material desires. Even liberation is a material desire. So, but if you desire to please Krishna, then you enter into Mahatmanas Tamam Partha Daivim Pakritim Asrita. You enter into the protection of Krishna. Krishna will protect you because you're desiring correctly. Just like if your kids are desiring correctly always, you'll do everything to help them. And if they're desiring incorrectly, you feel very discouraged. And you try and correct them. Help them or correct them. Right? You're not going to encourage them to keep desiring the wrong things. Then you're responsible. So here, Krishna is beginning to give a hint to Arjuna. He says, my dear Arjuna, this is verse 2 of Bhagavad Gita, chapter 2. How have these impurities come upon you? They are not at all befitting a man who knows the value of life. They lead not to higher planets, but to infamy. And he uses the word anarya justam, anarya. So arya means, in English we have the word Aryan, they say. But Sanskrit is Aryan. Aryan means a civilization whose goal is to train people to go back to Godhead. That's the goal of civilization. It's not to train people to engage in sense gratification. And to do that, make money. And to make money, give up, you just engage in industry. That's not Aryan, that's Asuric civilization. Aryan civilization, everything is organized in society to help people go back to Godhead. So Krishna is calling Arjuna anarya. Your behavior is anarya. It's not proper behavior. It's not proper behavior for someone who wants to go back to Godhead. This false compassion for the body rather than for the soul. So now we see he's getting, you know, after Arjuna seemed to have the upper hand in the first chapter, but giving all these very eloquent arguments why he shouldn't fight. And they all sound correct. They all sound correct. Right? They're correct on a mundane level, incorrect on the transcendental level. On a mundane level, they're correct, in, you know, from mundane morality. But Bhagavad Gita is not about mundane morality. It's about transcendental truth, transcendental morality. There's a difference. Okay, so then Krishna says that, O son of Prita, do not yield to this degrading impotence. Impotence means you're without any strength. Now Arjuna's, you know, he's got big muscles like this, right? But he's all limp like that. Why? Because of Swajanam, my kinsmen, my people, my family. So, I can't fight. You know, he's become a wimp. So he says, do not yield to this degrading impotence. It does not become you. Give up such petty weakness of heart and arise, O chastiser of the enemy. Then Arjuna comes back. He said, O killer of enemies, O killer of Madhu, how can I counteract? I counterattack with arrows in battle. Men like Bhisma and Drona, who are worthy of my worship. And that's true. That's true. But now we're going to learn a big lesson. If you might be the best person in the world, but if you follow the wrong path, then you lose your respectability. If you follow the wrong teacher, then whatever happens to the teacher is going to happen to you, even though you're sincere. And there's an example of this. Once there was a large group of people that accepted someone as a guru, but he wasn't a guru. He was a false teacher. So the Guru ordered them to build a stone boat. So they spent all their money, they built the stone boat. And on the launch of the boat, they all got on, and they were all chanting, you know, mantras and everything, and doing pujas to Ganapati and Lakshmi Devi and everybody, Shivaji, Durga Ma. And as soon as the boat launched, it sunk and they all died. When they died, Yamaraj came. And he started picking them all over here, over here. So, you know, he first was the guru. He said, you're going to hell. Okay, you come. And the people said, wait a minute. What do you mean we're going to hell? We're chanting mantras, we're chanting Vedic mantras, we're doing pujas. How did we know he was a cheater? He said, oh, but you chose him. He said, yeah, but we didn't know. We were sincere. He said, yeah, you sincerely follow the cheater. Therefore, you're going to hell. They all went to hell. And they suffered. This is in the sixth canto of Srimad Bhagavatam. This is serious business. You follow the wrong person, and you go, whatever happens to that person happens to you. So this is what's going to happen here. Bhishma, Pita, Maha, for whatever reason, Dronacharya, for whatever reason, they're following Duryodhan. So whatever's going to happen to Duryodhan is going to happen to them. Right? Meaning, they're all going to be killed on the battlefield. Which happens. They have to be killed because they didn't speak up when Draupadi was reviled and defiled. They were all there. They all saw what happened. They didn't say one word. And then Arjuna is very eloquent. He said, but it would be better to live in this world by begging than to live at the cost of the lives of great souls who are my teachers. Even though desiring worldly gain, they are superiors. If they are killed, everything we enjoy will be tainted with blood. Wow. This is very eloquent, very passionate statement, but it's nonsense. It's true on one level, but in front of Krishna, in this particular situation, it's nonsense. Utter hogwash nonsense. But the ordinary person will say, wow, man, this Arjuna, what a wonderful person he is. This Krishna must be mean. Nor do we know which is better, conquering them or being conquered by them. If we kill the sons of Dhritarashtra, we should not care to live. Yet they are now standing before us on the battlefield. This is life. This is real life. Sometimes there's situations that it's just bewildering. You don't know what to do. It's one thing, you know, if someone is your natural enemy, right? But it's another thing when your own family members turn against you. I mean, what are you going to do? You're going to turn against them also? It can be very bewildering, you know. I mean, you would expect people who are your natural enemies, but you don't expect people that are close to you. It just makes people go crazy. They don't know what to do. So then Arjuna begins to get very serious, even though he says all these things. He says, Karpanya dosa pahata swabhava prichami tvam dharma samudha cheta yatshe yaksya nishitam bruhitam me sisyasite ham sadimam tvam papanam. And this is a verse you should definitely memorize. Now I'm confused about my duty and have lost all composure because of miserly weakness. In this condition, I am asking you, meaning Krishna, to tell me for certain what is best for me. Now I am your disciple, and a soul surrendered unto you, please instruct me. Now see, this is the difference between the demons and the devotees. When the demons get confused, they don't say this. Now, Vasudeva was confused. So who does he take instruction from? Who does he take advice from? Who does he take solace from? The demons. And they convince him to put... And put the Vasudeva and Devaki back into prison. And now they're going to go and kill every child looking for Krishna. What kind of plan is that? That's the demon's plan. You know, kill them, kill everyone. It was just a fluke of providence that you didn't kill the eighth child. We'll find the eighth child. We'll kill him. Don't worry. Look at our power. So if you take advice from demons, what happens to you? You become a demon. Just like Prabhupada, when he was a little boy, he was sick, and his father and mother took him to a doctor. The doctor said, there's only one way to cure the sickness. Chicken soup. Murgi dal. Prabhupada's mother said, okay, I'll make it for him. Prabhupada's father said, no way. My son's not going to eat murgi dal. That's nonsense. He's a devotee. He said, what, you're trying to kill your boy? You see, you would expect that from someone outside, but now it's in the family. The wife is accusing the father of wanting to kill the son. He said, no way, he's not taking any chicken soup. And he didn't die. And he didn't take chicken soup. But this is what happens. You go to the demons, and they recommend Asurik Oshad. There's Deva Oshad, Manasa Oshad, and Asurik Oshad. Deva Oshad, or Deva medicine, are mantras. You heal with mantras. Manasa Oshad are Ayurvedic herbs and things like that. Good diet and herbs. Asurik Oshad are poisons. Chemotherapy, radiation therapy, allopathic medicines, this thing, that thing. They're actually poisons. One poison kills another poison. Well, it's true in a sense. Homeopathic medicine is the same thing. They're microscopic amounts of poisons, like dead extracts from dead lizards and things like that. If you looked at all, they give these different names you don't understand, but if you looked at what those things actually are, many of them are poisonous things that are against the principles of Krishna consciousness. But in microscopic, if you put, half of 1% of stool, you wouldn't notice it, right? But what are you taking? You're taking stool. Well, you wouldn't notice it, right? Because it's so small, you wouldn't notice it. And it's mixed in with other things, right? But it's stool, after all. Okay, so Sisyasteham sadimam tvam prapanam. So Arjuna is saying, now I'm a soul surrendered unto you. I want to be your disciple. You instruct me. So this is the beginning of spiritual life. This decision, I'm not going to go to the demons. I'm going to go to Krishna and his representatives. I'm not going to walk into the desert looking for water. I'm going to walk into the forest looking for water, because there's no water in the desert. Right? So, by nature's own way, the complete system of material activities is a source of perplexity for everyone. Perplexity means confusion. Everyone gets confused by the contrary situations that we encounter in material life. In every step there is perplexity, and therefore it behooves one to approach a bona fide spiritual master who can give one proper guidance for executing the purpose of life. All Vedic literatures advise us to approach a bona fide spiritual master to get free from the perplexities of life, which happen without our desire. No, we didn't want these things. They happen anyway. Now, of course, this is going to bring up a big question. Who is a bona fide spiritual master? That's a very important question. But it's easily answered. Krishna is the original guru. So if you learn Bhagavad Gita in the same way Arjuna learned Bhagavad Gita, and you come to the same conclusion as Arjuna, then anyone who speaks Krishna Upadesh, the instruction of Krishna, correctly, that's a guru. Bona fide. But you have to know what Krishna Upadesha is, Krishna's instructions are to Arjuna. And you have to come to the same conclusion as Arjuna. That is, whatever you say, Krishna, that's what I'm going to do. Now, what does Krishna say? What does Krishna want us to do? What is Krishna's instruction to us? Well, if you look in the 18th chapter, Natsatasman Manishesu Kashchit Nebhikritama Vavita Natchame Tasman Anyak Priyataro Uvi. So 1868 and 9. Ya itam paramam guyam mad bhakti sabidasiti bhakti mai param kripa mam evaisasya samsaya. For one who explains the supreme secret to the devotees, pure devotional service is guaranteed, and at the end he will come back to me. So this is referring to Bhagavad Gita, which is the supreme secret. Raja guyam, supreme secret. Raja Vidya, the supreme knowledge. Raja Guyam, the supreme secret, right? Then he says, there's no servant in the world more dear to me than he, nor will there ever be one more dear. So this is Krishna's order to us. So now we know Madhava Gauranga Prabhu is a genuine representative of Krishna. He's teaching Bhagavad Gita. He's not teaching Das Kapital by Karl Marx. He's not teaching, the Proletarian Revolution by Mao Zedong. He's not teaching Sigmund Freud's sexology philosophy. He's teaching Bhagavad Gita. So therefore, he is Anya Priyataro Bhuvi. There's no servant in the world more dear to me than he, nor will there ever be one more dear. You teach Bhagavad Gita yata rup, as it is, not as I think it should be, or I wish it was like this, or wouldn't it be nice if we could say it's like that. No. Yata rup, as it actually is. As it actually is means when you read real Bhagavad Gita, you decide also like Arjuna to become Krishna Bhakta. Rest of your life. That means you read Bhagavad Gita. And if you read Bhagavad Gita and you're convinced that you are Krishna, then you didn't read Bhagavad Gita, you read some other book. You know, I don't know what book. It looked like Bhagavad Gita, but you came to the wrong conclusion. See? Okay, so now, from the moment that Arjuna agrees to surrender to Krishna and accept him as his guru, the argument is over. From this point on, there are questions asked submissively and there are answers given thoroughly. So before that, Krishna didn't give too much instruction. You know, there was a little bit back and forth, but it wasn't real serious communication. You know. And you can tell, because most of it is Arjuna's passionate, you know, reasons why he shouldn't do his duty. Basically, he was saying no to Krishna. So, this tells us something very important. This belies the statement that everyone makes. Well, I don't see God today, so I don't. How do you expect me to believe in him? Well, even people who saw God didn't believe in him. What are you talking about? Even Arjuna is looking straight at God, he's saying no to him. Sisupala is looking straight at God, he's saying, this guy's a rascal. But that's complete nonsense. First, you have to be qualified to recognize God. It's not that seeing is believing. So many people saw Jesus. They didn't think he was the Son of God. They crucified him. They defiled him. They insulted him. They treated him, you know, with disdain. So many people saw Krishna. Pondraka saw Krishna. What did he say? He said, Krishna, you're a rascal, you're imitating me. I'm the Supreme Personality of God. Can't you see? I have four arms. So he had pasted two extra arms on him. Like, and had a golden crown and dressed in yellow silk and had some kind of fake Kostuba jewel made in some, you know, factory in Jaipur. You know. you know, he dressed like Vishnu. He had some kind of a false chakra, you know, in one of his false arms. And Krishna just laughed at him. He said, okay, you're going to kill me. Now I'm going to show you what the real chakra can do. He threw the chakra and cut his head off. That was the end of Pundraka. So many people are imitating Pundraka today. You know, if we went on Doordarshan and announced we're going to give prize of $1 million if the real Bhagavan would please stand up. Now, how many people do you think would stand up in India? How many people do you think? Huh? How many people? What, give a guess. A million. Well, at least 1 million people would stand up. They would claim to be Bhagavan. Right? And there's new Bhagavans every day. So you see, there's complete chaos. So if you learn what the real Bhagavan is saying in his discussion with Arjuna, then it's not difficult to see who is a real guru and who's a kangaroo. So here, if you look in the purport to 1.7, in the last paragraph, it says, Arjuna could understand that his affection for family members and his wish to protect them from death were the causes of his perplexities. Although he could understand that his duty to fight was awaiting him, still on account of miserly weakness, he could not discharge the duties. It's the last paragraph. He is therefore asking Lord Krishna, the Supreme Spiritual Master, to make a definite solution. In other words, he can't decide. He's saying, you be my guru, you teach me now. He offers himself to Krishna. No, see, here's the point. He is therefore asking Lord Krishna, the Supreme Spiritual Master. That's the point. If you want to accept the Spiritual Master, the first step is to accept that Krishna is the Supreme Spiritual Master, the original Spiritual Master. That's the first step in accepting a bona fide Spiritual Master. You don't just say, oh, I accept this guy because, you know, when I looked at him, oh, his eyes went around like that, and I felt this heat on my forehead, and all of a sudden I could see in my mind that he is God. Well, is that the criterion? You saw something, you felt some heat. What if he had an electric heater blowing heat your way? You don't know. You know, people are. You know, there was this one man in America called Jim Jones. He was a pseudo Christian preacher. But it was very dramatic. So people would come up and say, oh, Mr. Jones, I got cancer on the throat. I can't hardly speak. You know, my husband doesn't know what to do. We're very poor. Can you help me, please? He said, okay, do you believe in Jesus? Yes, I believe. And he put his hands on her head, you know, and he went like this. May you be healed. And all of a sudden, out of her mouth came this thing. It was all red and bloody. And he said, this is your cancer! This is your cancer! You're healed! He said, oh, please, God, I'm healed! I'm healed! Thank you so much! And she went around showing everybody this thing. You know, what was that thing? It was a chicken gizzard. You know what a chicken gizzard is? It's the throat of the chicken when they take the skin off. It's red and it's bloody. The whole thing was a show, but it was a good show. Everyone was entertained, and everyone said, hallelujah, hallelujah, praise Jesus! They're all, you know, everyone's up there putting their arms up like this, and the rock band is playing some Jesus music, and they're all swaying back and forth with their hands up, and the lady's going around showing everyone the gizzard, you know, and they're all, hallelujah, you're healed. You believe it? Yeah, it actually happened. This man was very, very popular, and then he decided that, you know, the American government was hassling, so he took his whole community, about, you know, hundreds of people to Guyana, and they opened a community there, so it would be far away from the United States. Then some United States House of Representatives, senators came to see them, and they were talking to them. Jim Jones ordered everyone to take cyanide. They all took cyanide, committed mass suicide. Hundreds of people, kids, old people, young people, they all died. So what happens when you follow a misleader? Now, people thought, oh, he healed cancer. We saw it with our own eyes. He didn't heal any cancer. It was a magical trick. It was an illusion. but people are dumb enough to believe illusions. There was one miracle man in Delhi, and so many people were coming to him for darshan, and they all have one trick, you know. So like, there's one man, he's called the Rolling Baba, so he rolls on the ground from Delhi to Katra, rolling. You ever read about him? Rolling Baba?
No. Yeah.
You read about him. There's another one, you know, Pilot Baba. He used to be an Air India pilot, right? So he's Pilot Baba. He does some trick. You know, everyone has it. Well, this guy's trick was tears would be flying out of his eyes like this. They would wet the people. And everyone said, oh, he's in Baba. He loves God so much. You know? So one person was really, you know, very close to him, loved him very much. So one day he hid in his private room just so he could have private darshan. So he came in after his show, you know, where all his tears were flying out. And he went like this. And he pulled a real long red chili out of his sinuses.
Ew.
The whole thing was a trick. He knew how to put a chili in his sinus so that he would always be tearing, the tears would fly out of his eyes. The whole thing is nonsense, but people love nonsense. They love to be lied to. They love to be tricked. And what? If someone becomes some miracle man because tears come out of his eyes or because he rolls on the ground from Delhi to Katra, is that the qualification for being some Bara Guru? It's all nonsense. Or because he gives you some basma and you put the basma in your house and your business starts doing better. Right? Or some gold necklace comes out from his hand like this. Is that the qualification for being Bhagavan? You see? And unless you read Bhagavad Gita, you will not know who is Bhagavan and who is a bag. You know, an empty bag. So Arjuna says, I can't find any way of driving away this grief, which is drying up my senses. I will not be able to dispel it, even if I win a prosperous, unrivaled kingdom on earth with sovereignty like the demigods in heaven. So he's waxing eloquently here. And then Sanjaya comes in and says, having spoken thus, Arjuna chastised the enemies, told Krishna, Govinda, I shall not fight, and fell silent. So, although he says, accept me as your guru, as your disciple, you're my guru, he still refuses to fight, to do his duty. So now, the stage is set for a dramatic question and answer. Because as soon as he says, you're my guru, I'm your disciple, then he's going to ask some questions. Krishna's going to answer him. Now, if Krishna answers his questions perfectly to his full satisfaction, that means it's his guru. And if he can't answer the questions, that means it's not his guru. So, one another, not only a guru is a integral representative of Krishna, in other words, he doesn't say anything that cannot be verified by the teaching of Krishna to Arjuna. In other words, whenever someone says something, you say, oh, Prabhu, can I ask you a question? Where does Krishna say what you just said? That's a legitimate question. See? And you have a right to ask that question at any time. And the person should be able to show you where Krishna says that in Bhagavad Gita. And if they can't, they say, well, I have to look this up and you give me a couple days. You say, okay, I'll wait a couple days. But if they never come back and show you, that means they're nonsense. And you don't have to listen to anything they say. Because they have to be able to back up everything they say with what the original guru has said. They just can't make things up. There's no, I think, maybe, what if, suppose that. That's all speculation. Anything starting with those phrases is called speculation. Speculation is not allowed in spiritual life. Either you know or you don't know. And if you don't know, there's nothing wrong with it. You can say, I don't know, but I will try and find the answer. But if you say, well, I think it might be like this and maybe like that, then immediately say, excuse me, I got to go to the bathroom. Go to the bathroom and don't come back. because the guy's a speculator. He doesn't. He's speculating. He's waning eloquently, waxing eloquently, but it doesn't mean anything. You don't come to a guru for an opinion. You come for the truth. Guru is someone who's pregnant with knowledge of who Krishna is and how to serve Krishna. So, what's the first thing Krishna says? Well, first he smiles. Right. And then he says, Asochan Anvasochastram Pradnavadam Sabhasase Gatasumadapasumcha Namasochan Tipanditaha. Supreme Personality of Godhead said, while speaking learned words, you are mourning for what is not worthy of grief. Those who are wise lament neither for the living nor for the dead. So that means he's not wise. He's a fool. He calls him a fool. That's guru. Immediately, if the disciple needs to be chastised, he will chastise. Not to hurt the disciple, but to set the record straight. That up until now, you're acting, you know, anarya. This is not the behavior of a progressive person in spiritual life. This is a behavior of low-class people. Yeah. And basically, Krishna is calling Arjuna a fool. So the Lord at once took the position of the teacher and chastised the student, calling him indirectly a fool. So this is called tough love in English, in colloquial American English. Tough love means you love someone, qui aime bien, châtie bien, as they say in French. If you love someone a lot, then you will also punish them when they need it. Not unnecessarily, but when they need it. To teach them. Right? So, what is punishment? Well, punishment means it's corrective measure. It's not to hurt a person. It's a corrective measure. So, Krishna's correcting Arjuna's inappropriate arguments. And now he begins to instruct him. Natve baham jatu na sam na tvam ne michana divaha na sarvena pavishya na chayvena pavishyama sarvavayama takpuram. Never was there a time that I did not exist, nor you, nor all these people, nor will there ever be a time when we shall cease to exist. That means that the soul is eternal before birth in the body, and after death of the body. It's full eternality. Now, in Christianity, they don't have full eternality. They, except for Jesus, they don't believe that we actually exist as a person before birth in the body. And at death, there are two destinies. Either we're eternally damned, or we're eternally saved, or we can actually be destroyed. Actually, three destinies. But no, according to Vedic philosophy, nitya nityanam chetanas chetananam iko bahunam yogudadati kamam tam atmastam ye nupasyanti dira te santi sasvati natarasam. Krishna is the supreme eternal amongst all eternals, and he is supplying necessities to the others, but he is self-sufficient. So this is, notice that Prabhupada is quoting from the Upanishads to support what Krishna says in his direct statement to Arjuna. That means that you cannot argue with this. The Upanishads, amongst scholars, are considered the highest philosophical authority in the Vedas. Right? Actually, Bhagavad Gita is called Gita Upanishad. It's even superior to the Upanishads. But in any case, for mundane scholars, they consider the Upanishads as the supreme authority. So therefore, Prabhupada is giving you Upanishadic evidence to back up what Krishna says for the people that have a few doubts. So then he begins to instruct Arjuna. He's already started. Now, dehinosmin yata dehe komaran yuvanam chara tadat dehantara pratir dhirastachana muyate. As the body, soul continually passes in this body from boyhood to youth to old age, the soul similarly passes into another body at death. A sober person is not bewildered by such a change. Now, how does the soul pass into the next body? Well, there are two material bodies. There's a subtle material body and a gross material body. Gross body is made of earth, water, fire, air, ether. subtle body is made of mind, intelligence, and false ego. Both bodies cover the soul. But the only thing that dies at death is the gross body. The subtle body doesn't die. The subtle body is the repository of desires. And basically karmic reactions. So that subtle body, which has a memory, that has of desires, that has, that is the recipient of the karmic reaction, carries the soul to the next gross body with that karma. Now, an interesting point that came out a couple days ago when we were reading the history of Mohini Murti in the Srimad Bhagavatam is that, and it's brought out here in Bhagavad Gita too, if you go to some Brahmin and say, Prabhuji, I have business problems, do you have some puja to improve business? He says, oh yeah, of course, I have mantras for improving business. I have mantras for backaches. I have mantras for marital problems. I have mantra for everything. Which mantra? Well, I just want business. Okay. Here's the mantra. It says, you know, you do this, you know, you have to do Sani Puja for 1 month, and you take the ahuti, and you have to put it out in the forest, and do it. You know, it tells you to do all these different things, right? And then you'll be all right. So you do all that, right? Expecting what? Expecting that he did the puja today, and you will get the result soon. Well, I'm sorry to tell you, it doesn't work like that. This is explained in first chapter, 32nd to 35th verse. And this is explained in depth also in the Srimad Bhagavatam. It doesn't work like that. See, Arjuna was addressing Krishna as Govinda, but his understanding of the word Govinda is incorrect. He thinks that the word Govinda means that he will satisfy my desires. Right. So, Govinda, so he satisfies the sense, you know, he is an object of pleasure for cows and senses. It doesn't mean that he pleases the cows and senses, but he's the object of pleasure for the cows and senses. Just like for some people, Seinfeld is the object of pleasure when they watch television. Right. Every episode he has a new girlfriend. So that's very interesting for some people. They think, oh, this is real entertainment. I like to see how he conquers this girl, you know. There's a difference between the object of pleasure and the supplier of pleasure. See? So Arjuna, by using this significant word, Arjuna indicates that Krishna should understand what will satisfy Arjuna's senses. See, you have to understand the English language and Sanskrit language. When you say it's the object of pleasure, does that imply that he supplies pleasure to you? Well, you could interpret it like that, but actually it's different than that. But Govinda is not meant for satisfying our senses. If we try to satisfy the senses of Govinda, however, then automatically our own senses are satisfied. This is what it means by object. It didn't mean, he could have easily said, Krishna is the order supplier for your sense gratification. That you would understand. But when he says the object of pleasure for the senses and cows, what does that mean? It's like he's turned it around a little bit. What it means that if Krishna is Hrishikesha, the owner of the senses, your senses, my senses, he owns all of them. So if we use our senses to please Krishna's senses, then our senses will be satisfied. That's what it means. It doesn't mean that he is the order supplier for our senses. It means that if we cooperate to please Krishna's senses, then our senses belonging to him will automatically be pleased also. Just like if you feed the stomach, your finger, your arm, your leg, they'll all be satisfied. So you could say the stomach is the object of pleasure for all the appendages of the body. Because if you cooperate with the stomach, then you're satisfied. Materially, everyone wants to satisfy his senses, and he wants God to be the order supplier for such satisfaction. Now, this is the key phrase. The Lord will satisfy the senses of the living entities as much as they deserve. Deserve how? Deserve by their previous karma. Okay. But not to the extent that they may covet, meaning not to the extent that they may desire. So your and my happiness and suffering in this life have already been predetermined by our previous karma. At birth, we receive a body that's already predetermined the amount of pleasure and the amount of suffering it's going to have. We're under the false conclusion, if I have a puja done today by this pundit, then this is going to change everything for me. That's not true. As long as our desire is to enjoy the result of that puja for ourselves and not to please Krishna, then we only get what we deserve. The pundit can't change anything. The karma has already been determined. But the Lord will satisfy senses of living entities as much as they deserve, but not to the extent that they may desire. But when one takes the opposite way, namely, when one tries to satisfy the senses of Govinda without desiring to satisfy one's own senses, then by the grace of Govinda, all the desires of the living entity, meaning all the spiritual desires, the pure desires that please Krishna, are satisfied. So it's a false idea that people have. I'll go to the pundit, I have my backache, and he'll have a mantra for my backache, and then my backache will go away. It's a false desire. If you're destined to have that backache, then it's not going to go away until the proper time, until that karmic reaction is finished. It's that the pundit can't really do anything about it. But there's the law of averages. The law of averages says, if you give 1,000 asirvads and one of them works, that's enough to make you God. That's enough to make you God. Like if you're in the asirvad business, ustadi business, asirvad. All you need is 1 in 1,000 that hits the jackpot. You'll be declared God. It's the law of averages. You see, 1 in 1,000, you know, maybe it's their karma that they're going to have some change of destiny at a certain time. You just keep giving enough asirvad, you're going to hit the jackpot. And that person will declare to the whole world, Guru Dev is a miracle man. I came to him and I had this problem. Now, look, all this money is coming in and I'm so successful, you know. And then everyone will run, oh, give me asirvad. You know, you just keep going. The more people you do, the law of averages are on your side. All you need is 1 in 1,000. See? It's a good business. You can't go wrong. So, this is a very important principle. This is explained also on 5:15. I'm digressing a little bit, but this is an important point. There are a lot of misconceptions people have. And because of these misconceptions, they can seriously be taken away from the path of pure devotional service. First of all, we should read one thing in the 18th chapter, 6th verse, where it says, all these activities, meaning all different yajnas and sacrifices, should be performed without attachment or any expectation of result. They should be performed as a matter of duty, O son of Prita. That is my final opinion. Although all sacrifices are purifying, one should not expect any result by such performances. In other words, all sacrifices which are meant for material advancement in life should be given up. But sacrifices that purify one's existence and elevate one to the spiritual plane should not be stopped. So, sacrifices that are meant to purify our existence and elevate one to the spiritual plane. In other words, sacrifices to please Krishna should not be given up, because those sacrifices are purifying. Everything that leads to Krishna consciousness must be encouraged. In the Srimad Bhagavatam also it is said that any activity that which leads to devotional service to the Lord should be accepted. That is the highest criterion of religion. A devotee of the Lord should accept any kind of work, sacrifice, or charity which will help him in the discharge of devotional service to the Lord. Okay? And this is further emphasized where it says Tasmada Sakta Samachara. Asakta Samachara Karyam Karma Karotiya. Okay, it's in the third chapter. Let me just find it.
Third chapter, 19th verse.
Tasmat Asakta Samachara Karyam Karma Karotiya. Natasya Sarvabhutes, Asakto hi, Tasma Asakta Satatam, Kayam Karma Samachara, Asakto hi Acharan Karma, Param Abnoti, Purushaha. Therefore, without being attached to the fruits of activities, one should act as a matter of duty, for by working without attachment, one attains the Supreme. So, all throughout the Bhagavad Gita, this point is made. Under no circumstances should we perform any sacrifice for personal benefit. All the sacrifices we perform should be for the pleasure of the Lord. And if the Lord gives us back some prasadam, we should be satisfied with that. There's no karmic reaction if we act like that. But if we're acting for personal benefit, then there's going to be some reaction, good or bad, and both those reactions entangle us in the material world. Okay? Good. So we'll come back again, second chapter. And Krishna now is beginning to really instruct. Matras sparsastu konteya sitosastu kudukadaha agamapayano nityas tamsitik satsuparata. Now he introduces a very important, absolutely essential principle in spiritual life, and that is titikshava. What is this titikshava? Just try to tolerate. If you have no tolerance ability in this life, you will be miserable. Every little thing will upset you, will make your mind disturbed. You won't be able to focus. You won't be able to be happy. Now, how can you tolerate something? Only if you have something so great that worrying about or becoming intolerant of a situation is insignificant. Because you have something so great that it cannot disturb the serenity of your mind. But if you have nothing, then any little thing disturbs you and you can't tolerate it. So in the proper discharge of duty, one has to learn to tolerate non-permanent appearances and disappearances. So everything in this world is non-permanent. It comes for a little while and then it goes away and is replaced by something else that comes for a little while and goes away. So therefore, there's a principle that history repeats itself. Therefore, history is eternal. If you see in history, there were so many summers and falls, then winter and spring. And there's still summer, fall, winter, and spring. So history is repeating itself, and it's going on eternally. You see? And people make mistakes in the past, and they make the same mistakes in the future. There's nothing new under the sun. The same mistakes that Duryodhana made 5,000 years ago, people are making today. They didn't learn any lessons from it. So history is repeating itself all the time. But we have to learn to tolerate things in order to continue to do our duty in spite of all the trouble. That's the point. Otherwise, you cannot continue doing your duty if you get disturbed by little things all the time, or big things. So this principle of tatikshava, learning to tolerate things, is absolutely essential. But you cannot do it artificially. You have to have something much greater than material happiness and distress. And what is that? Krishna consciousness. And that's explained in this verse a little bit later. It says that verse, 40. Vishaya vinivartante nirahara siddehina rasavarjam rasapiyasya param dristva nivartate. So that's not 40, it's verse number Vishaya
vinivartante.
59. The embodied soul may be restricted from sense enjoyment, though the taste for sense object remains, but ceasing such engagements by experiencing a higher taste, he's fixed in consciousness. Very important. How do we get that higher taste? So that's what we're teaching here. How do we get that higher taste? Well, what is it that everybody desires? Let's say every Hindu. Well, everybody. Peace, shanti, shanti, shanti. Sarve bhuvantu sukhinaha, sarve santu niramayaha, sarve badrani pasyantu, ma kaschit dukabak bhavet. Om shanti, shanti, shanti. Everybody wants shanti. But how to get shanti, right? That's explained in Bhagavad Gita's second chapter, where it says, Na asti buddhir ayuktasya, na cha yuktasya bhavana, na cha bhavya taksantir santasya kutasakam. It says, second chapter, and 66th verse. One who is not connected with the Supreme in Krishna consciousness, in other words, one who has no connection, ayukta. Yukta means following the instructions of spiritual master, bona fide spiritual master, so that you actually please Krishna. Factually. Right? Then you are yukta, you're connected to Krishna. Then someone says, oh, Madhava Gurna, I love you, pyar, pyar. So, oh, I'm very happy you love me. You know, next week I'm going to move into a new house. Can you help me? Oh, no, next week I have something to do. Okay. How about the week after that? Oh, no, I'm doing something else. How about the week after that? No, I'm going on vacation. Oh, okay. How about right now? No, my back hurts. I can't do it. So, wait a minute. Now, what does this PR mean? You know, I love you. But it doesn't mean anything. He's not willing to do anything for me, but yet he says PR. What does PR mean? It's just an empty word. Doesn't mean anything. It would only mean something if they're willing to help do something that's useful, right? To have some meaningful exchange. You know, I'll help you, you help me, okay, then you can say PR. But you don't help me, I don't help you, then what does it mean? It doesn't mean anything. So, therefore, if we have a connection to Krishna, how is that connection? Well, one symptom of the connection is that we have buddhi. Nasti yuktir. Na asti. Nasti buddhir ayuktasya. Nacha buyak. Nacha yuktasya bhavana. So, we have buddhi. We have good intelligence. Good intelligence means we're making good decisions in our life. Decisions that help us maintain ourselves in Krishna consciousness. So when you have a connection, if you don't have connection to Krishna, then you don't have good intelligence and you don't have a steady mind. The Western disease, Prabhupada said, is two diseases in the West. One, always changing your mind, and two, having sex addiction. These are the two diseases of Western civilization. This always changing. Well, I don't want to chant. I'm going to sit home and watch television. You know, I have to go to the kitchen and cook. I don't want to cook. I'll just call up. Hey, Rasavati, I'm a little sick. You can cook. Okay, good. You know, this changing mind, this chanchal, this whimsical mind. One day I do, next day I don't want to do. You know, this is a symptom. This is a Western symptom of, you know, lack of determination to actually make tangible spiritual progress. So, one doesn't have good intelligence, one doesn't have a steady mind, one is not fixed a mind. Come hell or high water, I'm going to do my service, I don't care. And then, Nachababiyatak Santir, if I don't have a fixed mind, which means my mind is not changing all the time, and it's actually happy, I'm getting my pleasure from actually doing service. I really feel happy when I do the service. I don't get pleasure anymore by smoking or drinking or going to the movie or talking nonsense. I get pleasure from this. So when that switch, that param drishtva, that higher taste is attained by regulated service, associating with devotees, hearing more about Krishna, at a certain point, you reach a threshold where your actual pleasure in life is this. It's sitting down, hearing Bhagavad Gita, discussing it. It's actually going out and doing practical service. It's becoming more expert in doing the service. The more you become expert in serving Krishna, the more you become expert in pleasing others also. You learn the art of pleasing. Speaking nicely, acting nicely, being genuine, truthful, no duplicity, and honest and clean, having a pure heart, pure mind. You know, it gives you a tremendous feeling of satisfaction. That's bhava, right? Satisfaction through Krishna conscious activities. So without this bhava, this internal satisfaction, change of taste, there's no peace of mind. Can you have peace of mind? You're always changing. Ah, today I want to be married to this man. No, I don't want to marry him anymore. I want to marry somebody else. No, I don't like that guy either. I want to marry somebody else. You know, is there any peace like that? It's all trouble. And if there's no peace, santasya kutasukam, then how can you be happy? If the mind is not peaceful, it's always changing, you can't be happy. So, one who is not connected with the Supreme in Krishna consciousness can have neither transcendental intelligence nor a steady mind, without which there is no possibility of peace. And how can there be any happiness without peace? And Prabhupada says, unless one is in Krishna consciousness, there's no possibility of peace. No possibility of it. You'll always be disturbed. Your tolerance factor will be very low. You'll always be full of duality. Should I do this? Should I do that? I love this person. I hate that person. It's too cold. No, now it's too hot. You never be happy. You can't tolerate anything. So therefore, now Krishna gives a lot of information in the second chapter. Many, many themes. We're not going to be able to cover them all today. But main thing now is to be able to control the senses by keeping them engaged always in Krishna consciousness and avoiding anything that agitates or artificially stimulates the mind and the senses for sense gratification. Right? So, if you watch Miley Cyrus or Lady Gaga perform, they'll stimulate your mind and senses for sense gratification. No doubt about it. You know, someone walks half naked in front of you and shakes their butt at you, you know, oh my God, this might be good. So any time you allow yourself to be enticed by those low-class things, it'll excite the mind to think that, yes, I think I'll be happier by sense gratification rather than controlling the senses. So therefore it says, 270 apuryamanam achalam patistam samudram apak pavisanti yadvat tadvat kamayam pravishanti sarve nasantim apnanti nakamakami. A person is not disturbed by the incessant flow of desires that enter like rivers into the ocean, which is ever being filled but is always still, can alone achieve peace, and not the man who strives to satisfy such desires. So in other words, we're never going to eliminate desires. Impossible. But you have to learn to tolerate inappropriate desires, not be enticed by them. And the only way to do that, you can't just sit there and say, I'm going to tolerate. That's not going to happen. You have to replace those desires with superior desires to please Krishna. Get that higher taste. Okay, I tried for so many lifetimes as a bird, as a worm, as a rat, as a bear to satisfy my desires for sense gratification. At least in the human life where I have human intelligence, I'm going to try and satisfy my spiritual desires to please Krishna, knowing that Krishna is the owner of my senses. Krishna is the goal of life. I have the implicit faith that if I please Krishna, I will be genuinely pleased by his mercy, by his prasad. This is something I've learned by being a bear, a rat, an ant, a germ, and a tiger. I tried in every body I had to please my senses. It didn't work that good. I ended up dying and taking birth again, starting all over. This life, I have human intelligence. I'm going to use it in a different way. Instead of working for my sense gratification, I'm going to work for Krishna's sense gratification, like the gopis, like the residents of Vrindavan. I'm going to see if that works. I tried everything else. Why can't I try this? Why should I chew the chewed? I already tried it so many times. Let me try something different. Instead of pleasing my own senses, I'm going to please try and work for Krishna's pleasure and see if it works. So then it says, Vihaya kamam yasarvam pumam charati nispra nirmama nirahankara sasantim adigachati. Now it's being very specific. A person who has given up all desires for sense gratification, who lives free from such material desires, who has given up all sense of proprietorship and is devoid of false ego, he alone can attain real shanti, real peace. That means if you have real peace, then you can have real happiness. And then it says, Ese brahmi stiti partha nainam pratyamimuyati stitvasyam antakalipi brahma nirvanam richati. That is the way of spiritual and godly life, trying to please Krishna's senses, not trying to please my own senses. If one is thus situated, even at the hour of death, one can enter into the kingdom of God. So now we see how pernicious modern education is. Modern education is focused on teaching us that we should work for our own sense gratification. And the modern politicians say, we're going to give you free health care. We're going to give you food stamps. We're going to give you jobs. We're going to give you... Oh my God. They're going to give me everything, right? Everything, but when I actually try and get it, there's nothing. I lost my job. They didn't accept me for this medical procedure. Before, I had the money to pay for it myself, but now I'm depending on the government. Some committee says you're not going to get it. Somebody else deserves it more than you. We have too many requests for that procedure. Oh, wait a minute. I was better off before when I was working. My sense gratification was better before I socialized. I agreed to socialize everything. But whether you have socialized benefits or you work in a capitalistic way to earn your own benefits, it's still sense gratification. What is he promising you? He's promising you sense gratification, implying that you don't have to work for it. It's all free. Well, whether you work for it or it's free, it's what? It's sense gratification. That's what they're selling. They're not selling going back to Godhead. They're selling staying in the material world and increasing your sense gratification. Is it? So this is what modern society is. And when there's war, it's a war for sense gratification. The Israelis want to have sense gratification in that little bit of land, and the Palestinians want to have sense gratification in that little bit of land. They're both fine. Or in Kashmir, they want to have Muslim sense gratification, or they want to have Hindu sense gratification. But it's sense gratification. They're not using that land to please God. Okay, they're saying Ganapati, or saying Allah, or whatever, but it's just words. It's like pyar. It's just a word. There's no actual substance to it. Therefore, this godly life is vihayakaman yasarvam pumamcha pinisra nirmama nirahankara sasante madigachati. No mama. So, when the pandit does the puja for you, Satnarayan puja, what does he make you say? Say mama. Mama. What does mama mean? It doesn't mean mommy. It means for me. This puja is for me. That's what it means. That's why he's asking you to say mama. Is it right or wrong? You say? What kind of puja is that? We just read it should not be for mama. It should be for Krishna, not mama. Right. So we're being misled by everybody. The politicians, the Brahmins, even our own family members. I said, Sonny, you don't want to be Hare Krishna. You'll be some bum. You know, you should be a doctor, lawyer, you should be, you know, liar, something. Make something of yourself. Be a liar. You know, you'll make a lot of money. What for? Why should I make life? What do you mean what for? For sense gratification. You can buy a sleep comfort bed. Electronic control. You know, in India, we sleep on these cots, so you get backache and everything. Now you go to America, you get sleep comfort bed. You buy new Toyota. You buy this, you buy that. You know. But what is it all about? It's all sense gratification. And if you're not getting enough sensory gratification, we go to war. We have atomic bomb. We have F-16 jets. We have everything. We'll blow them up. We'll blow up everybody so that we have more sense gratification. So this verse, Vihaya Kamam Yasarvam, it's near the end of the chapter. This is explaining what is the path to back to Godhead. Tasmad Sakta Satatam Karyam Karma Samachara Asakto Hi Acharan Karma Paramapnoti Purusha. We should work as a matter of duty without attachment to the result. For by working without attachment and offering the result to Krishna, one attains freedom from the cycle of birth. This theme is, you want to hear it throughout the whole Bhagavad Gita. Now, is it possible to work without attachment to the result? It doesn't, see, there's two ways of interpreting the Shastra. One is called the Mayavad way, and the other is called the Bhagavad way. Mayavad way says, where can I have attachment? That means no attachment. That means no Krishna also. But wait a minute, that's throwing the baby out with the bathwater. You say, oh, the water of my baby is dirty. You go like this, but you know, you throw the baby out also. That's not intelligence. See? No, the desire to please Krishna is spiritual. The desire to please yourself is material. They're very simple. So we don't throw Krishna out. We throw out junk desires. See? We throw out the rubbish, not the fresh fruit. You know. So we have to understand. So there's two ways of interpreting the scripture. And the prevalent way is the Mayavad way, you know, minus Krishna, minus Krishna, minus Krishna, minus Krishna. Take Krishna out. Everywhere is Krishna. You say, oh, this is the unknown. This is the imperceptible oneness. Well, wait a minute. Is your child imperceptible oneness? Is your child an unknown? Mm-hmm. Huh? Mm-hmm. But the Mayavadis will make everything zero or unknown or imperceptible. Let's meditate on the Non-sensual oneness. What kind of nonsense is that? I'm using my senses to meditate, and you're saying I have to meditate on non-sensual stuff. That's crazy. But that's Mayavad philosophy. That's why it's called Mayavad, worshipping something that doesn't exist. Maya means doesn't exist. Maya, like the egg of a horse. Yeah, you know what it means, but you look for it, you can't find it. Okay, so we'll stop right there. That's one summary. There are many other summaries we could make, but because there's so much information here. You learn this chapter, it's a summary of the whole Bhagavad Gita. The rest of the Bhagavad Gita is just going to explain the themes that are mentioned. But the main theme is people have the wrong conclusion that life is meant for my selfish pleasure. I'm number one. Everybody else is number two. And kids learn it. They imbibe it. Just by watching Disney films, going to kindergarten. By the time they're 6 years old, 7 years old, they're already contaminated by this sense gratification philosophy. And then the rest of their life, they're trying to unlearn it. So unless they are trained right from childhood to be Krishna conscious, you just be doing damage control the rest of your life with those kids. You're not really going to make any progress because they're being bombarded. You know, all the Disney movies, all the television programs for kids, all the games for kids, you know. Your kid can learn to read, you know. And they see, you know, Dumbo says hello. Wait a minute, who's Dumbo? Why do they have Dumbo saying hello? Why don't they have Hanuman saying hello? Right? Well, because that's the culture. It's Dumbo, you know, dumb you down culture. You know. And everything they see, you know, all the advertisements for the cold cereals, it's all based on sense gratification. Oh, buy cornflakes, you know. So, you know, mommy, I want cornflakes. How do they know cornflakes is good for them? They don't know. They just saw on television that they should eat cornflakes. Then, so you go to Safeway and you buy 1 year's supply of cornflakes. It's big box like this. You know, you say, oh, I got a deal. I only paid $40. I saved. You know, instead of going to Safeway and paying $80, I paid $40. $40 of junk food for 1 year for your kid. You don't know. We're all just following, you know, Dumbo said. So I think, you know, you read Bhagavad Gita, you carefully think about all these things. It should always be Krishna said, not Dumbo said. Hare Bol. Thank you. All glories to Prabhupada. Hare Krishna.
Any questions? No question?
Huh?
You all have so many questions during, you know, our regular class.
Nobody.
Sure, nobody has any questions?
Why is the second chapter the contents of Gita summarized, whereas the details come later?
This is the Vedic way.
They summarize it first.
Summarize it first and then develop it, you know, in detail. That's the way everything happens in the Vedas. They'll give you the bij, the seed, and then they grow the seed to fruition. So now Bhagavad Gita is undergraduate studies. Therefore, everything explained in Bhagavad Gita is going to be expanded unbelievably in the Srimad Bhagavatam. A plethora of more information substantiating everything that's already established in Bhagavad Gita. It's just a Vedic way. And it makes sense, doesn't it? Mm-hmm. You introduce the themes, and then you expand upon them until there's no doubt.
And it'll also pique your interest. You know that
because you're going to keep learning more and more about the same thing. Just like 2 plus 2 you learn in kindergarten, right? But there's 2 plus 2 in college, in calculus also, and 2 plus 2 in differential equations, and 2 plus 2 in, you know, quantum mechanics. So, but your understanding of 2 plus 2 increases. Does 2 plus 2 equal 4? Yes. Does it ever equal 3? Well, some people might teach mathematics like that. Then you're in trouble. Say 2 plus 2 will always equal 4. You know, when they say it equals 3, then you know you have to excuse yourselves. I have to go to the toilet. You know? You leave and don't come back. Haribo.
Thank you, please.